So anyway, you know, this question about regulatory versus coding evolution is an old issue, and people have touched on it. It dates back maybe 50, 60 years to some comments made by Britton and Davidson, who actually I think were the first to bring this idea up, namely that when they started looking at DNA hybridization methods by just slamming together genomes of two different species and asking how well they hybridize, before you could sequence genomes, you get some idea of how similar they were by looking at these so-called Cott curves. They discovered humans and chimps are awfully similar.
This was 50 years ago.
Yeah, it was in the 60s or something like that. And they already raised the idea that the divergence at the DNA level is so small that it seems unlikely that just, you know, I mean, a typical protein's a couple of hundred amino acids, there's only 1% divergence genome-wide, there can't be much divergence at the protein level, that perhaps these kind of major morphological and other type of changes that have occurred between, say, humans and chimps must be regulatory. And so that has kind of, you know, been sitting in the background. When I started my career looking at DNA sequence polymorphism, we looked in non-coding regions to compare it to coding regions, knowing that those non-coding regions contained regulatory sequences, although at the time, eukaryotic gene regulation was not understood at all. Of course, we did have the bacterial model of the operon, but it was pretty clear that eukaryotes didn't have that kind of gene regulation structure. And it just kind of sat there until I heard a talk by a Drosophila geneticist who was working on pattern formation in embryogenesis. And I'll tell you a lot about that. It's really a beautiful cascade of transcription factors, so things that regulate gene expression, turning on other genes that regulate gene expression, that turn on other genes that regulate gene expression. So it's a cascade of kind of regulatory expression, which sets up the anterior, posterior, and the dorsal ventral axis of the embryo. It creates all the landmarks that tell cells where they are in the embryo and directs them to become a certain type of cell. And there was a beautiful amount of genetic work done on that. And since it is this regulatory cascade, it quickly became of interest, once all the genes were identified, to identify, well, this gene turns on that gene. How does it turn it on in this regulatory cascade? So people started identifying the non-coding regions to which the upstream transcription factors were binding and worked out the actual regulatory structure of some of these little units of DNA, which I call enhancers, for several of these. And one of them, the Eve-Stripe-2 enhancer, which I'll tell you about, was really beautifully kind of worked out. First, just purely on genetic grounds. That is to say, they simply knew all the upstream genes that were required to make the downstream Eve stripes. And so they basically knew ahead of time that there were four transcription factors that must be binding to an upstream coding region that's required to turn on that stripe, a single stripe of expression. And so then it was a matter of just finding where that piece of DNA was and then mapping those binding sites. So it was really one of the first eukaryotic pieces of DNA. It was very well characterized structurally. And what they showed was also that they physically mapped these binding sites, and they also knocked them out. Well, that's what good geneticists do. And showed that, you know, indeed, the genetics say that bicoid is an activator, so let's knock out the bicoid sites and we ought to lose activation. This is a posterior repressor. Let's knock it out and see if it, you know, expands the posterior of the stripe expression. So they just kind of experiments, and sure enough, it's true. But they also played all kind of games, because there's two of those, there's two repressors, and actually three, as it turns out, and two activators. And they started playing some games. They said, well, it became pretty clear already that, you know, these enhancers have degenerate binding site sequences. What happens if we take a site that's weak and make it stronger? What if we move the position of one of these binding sites? What if we knock one out and create, put another one here? And they showed that they could produce a lot of compensation. Not necessarily perfect. The assay was relatively crude, but it was very clear from these beautiful experiments that there was a lot of flexibility in the architecture of these enhancers to kind of produce a stripe. They had no evolutionary data on the evolution of the architecture, but just clearly on these experimental grounds, it seemed to me that it just seems like there's a lot of flexibility. And of course, that's one of the kind of remarkable things about these regulatory sequences, and that is the tremendous breadth of their expressivity. I mean, it's almost very much like human language. You know, we have a million ways of saying the same thing in words, and an equally large number of ways of saying the same thing with very subtle difference because of the richness of our language. Probably we couldn't have such a rich language if it didn't have the capacity to evolve. And indeed, a language evolves very, very quickly, and it produces the hundreds of languages that we have around the world. And in some sense, so it is with these kind of regulatory architectures. They seem to have this great capacity to evolve in many kind of subtle ways and have this great breadth of expressivity. And we're still, well, I wouldn't say we're in the early stages, we're in the middle stages of kind of figuring out how that works, what the implications are for evolution.
Well, you're saying, well, the means of figuring out things was with the expression of Eve, what controlled that. That was the sort of key canonical system, was it? So the role of the four transcription factors.
Yeah, and I'm going to tell you, I'll show you that in great detail. Okay, so let me just move on. The actual, if there is a point to my talk, it's been a slightly different view than Vili presented in the first half of his talk, where he argued for a model of binding site turnover that involved selection, but in many cases perhaps no net adaptation, where there was clearly binding sites are gained and lost. They're not purely drifting and genetically neutral. They're controlled by selection. But perhaps in many cases, the actual phenotype expression itself remains fairly well conserved. And there's just some kind of this churning process going on as a very useful null model. I would say that with the work we've been doing, I'll tell you, that we have some sense that there is a definite directional component to this cis evolution. And that's what I want to tell you about. Actually, let me switch over to the slideshow. Get there. Okay, and maybe I can. I don't know if you can see the bottom. So I'm going to talk about one, two, three, four different pieces of research. The first is work actually by a colleague of mine, Ilya Bravinsky's. That shows that this kind of binding turnover, the turnover model, fails at a limit of long time scale. And that is to say, if you take a piece of regulatory DNA that seems to be doing the same thing in two distantly related species, and you take it from one species and put it in the other species, does it work? And he did a really beautiful definitive study on that. But I think it's under kind of appreciated. Then I'm going to tell you about the mainstay of the work we've been doing in my lab, work headed by a colleague of mine, Michael Ludwig, on the even skip stripe to enhancer, and quite a bit about that. Then I'm going to tell you briefly about some current work that a graduate student of mine is doing, Bin He, actually looking at transcription factor binding site sequences and their turnover between two closely related species. And then, if I have time, I'm going to tell you about work of a recent former graduate student, Susan Lott, who's looked at the evolution of the actual patterning itself. That is to say, we began to ask, do flies put their stripes in the same place, or does that actually evolve? And I think all of these point in the same direction, that all these different ways of looking at enhancer and regulatory evolution indicate that there is some component of directional evolution. Okay, so let me just start with this question that Ilya addressed. And here's what he did. It's kind of neat. He picked this bunch of genes, I don't know, there's about 20 there or something, that are present as clean orthologs between the worm, Caenorhabditis, and the fruit fly, Drosophila. So this, I don't know what the time is, but it's, you know, many hundreds of millions of years diverged. But these are all important developmentally regulated genes, and includes actually even skip as one of them. You can identify one for one ortholog in the two species. And importantly, all of these genes are expressed in exactly the same tissues, and in many cases, the exact homologous cell in both of the species. So some of these are expressed in whatever this is, I don't know, FMRC, ergic neurons. So there's some very specific neurons, and they're expressed in the same bloody neurons in both of those species. It's very clear it's the orthologous gene, they're present in the common ancestor, and that regulation was obviously already established in the common ancestor of these two species, and it's presumably been maintained. And so it is with all of these cases. Now, it is also the case for all of these genes that Drosophila geneticists identified the regulatory piece of DNA that drives these patterns of expression. So the expression patterns are the same in the two species for these genes, and we have the regulatory sequence that drives that expression in Drosophila. So the experiment is to take the piece of regulatory DNA, put it in the worm, and ask, can it read out the worm kind of trans environment and express properly? And I want to go through these, just some examples of these genes, and you can see this panel A, I don't know, Drosophila GAD1, so these are GFP, he just made these kind of GFP transgenes to see how they drive expression. It's expressed in glial cells in the head instead of the GABAergic neurons. So it's supposed to express in these particular neurons, expressed somewhere else. Here's F down at the bottom, but all these are the same kind of example. This other gene, NOMPA, is expressed in the head, hypoderm, and in several aphid neurons instead of glial cells and ciliated neurons.
So here it's the regulatory region, yeah, which is being changed. The transcription factors are left.
Yeah, that's right. You're just taking the regulatory piece of DNA that, so if you take this piece of regulatory DNA and put a GFP, you know, output on it, and put it back in the fly, it drives expression in exactly the appropriate set of cells. So, but now you're putting in the worm, and that's what it does. And these are all examples where they don't seem to, they drive expression, but they do it in the wrong set of cells. And of course, the worm is really beautiful because it has a small number of cells, and you can really look cell for cell what they're doing, as you can sort of see here.
Mapping of cell types between Drosophila.
Well, at you know, I don't know, but at some level, it may not be perfect mapping. But as I say, there's many, many examples here, and some of them are very, very highly specific. And undoubtedly, the mapping is very good. But I would not claim to know that it's perfect. But it's he chose these examples because they do have this very good evidence for homology of the.
Are there examples where these works? I mean, taking the regulatory region, putting in another animal, and actually see that it works. Are there examples of this case?
Oh. Well, sure. There are examples of where you can do that for sure. And for example, and many things between mouse and human work quite well. You take human and express it perfectly. Mouse. I'm going to show you other examples where it does. Yeah, sure. And I'll tell you all about that. But anyway, so here's sort of the observed pattern for all of these genes. And the point is that there's basically not a single bloody one of them. 20 out of 20, you know, 0 out of 20 that express properly. They all drive some expression, but it's misexpression. So it's pretty clear that there's been, over that evolutionary period of time, some enough evolution of the trans environment such that these cis regulatory sequences have evolved to the point where they simply don't recognize the inputs and drive some kind of misexpression.
20 was a sort of full set of ones that was tried in this.
These are all the ones he looked at, yeah. Every single one of them. None of them work.
Okay.
None of them work. So that's one of the reasons I like it, because I think, you know, it's pretty clear. At that time scale...
Can we do the reverse, too?
You could do the reverse, but he didn't. One could do the reverse. The thing is, the Drosophila geneticists had identified those regulatory regions, and they're less well characterized in the worm. So for some of them, you can do that. But actually, in cases where people have done that, they generally don't work. So I think one can assume there's reciprocity in these two things. He also did some work saying, okay, well, at that evolutionary timescale, things don't work. Let's just look at two worm species. Just as people do human and mouse, Drosophila briggsi is sort of the frame of evolutionary comparison that people do. It's somewhat more distantly related than human is to mouse. Well, not closely related, but it's in the same genus. And I don't want to say, he looked at one particular gene, UNC47, and these pictures actually show that these things, when you take briggsi and put it into elegans, it generates this pattern of neuron expression, but there is some ectopic expression of some additional neurons that it fires that normally wouldn't be fired. So it kind of works, but not perfectly, even at that time scale. So just, you know, that's just,
if you actually take, I mean, not have it expressed GFP, but actually replace it as the regulatory region, do you get...
People have not done those experiments, but I'm going to show you one that we did, but it's one of the only ones that where people have actually done that kind of experiment. So I'm going to talk about that. So Ilya, now they proposed, this was done by Ravinsky and Rufkin when he was a postdoc in Gary Rufkin's lab, and he proposed a model where you have these two species, species A and species B, and not only do the binding sites shown in these triangles or circles or squares, but also the transcription factors evolve between the species. So sort of the blue has evolved to red, but in both components of this cis-trans system, so that when you put these components together between the species, some things don't work in either combination. Either you have the wrong cis kind of sequences that are not recognized by the transcription factors, or the transcription factors have evolved and don't. So that's...
The interesting thing is not that they don't work, they just work in different places.
Yeah. Well, that's actually right. And in many of these cases, if you look at the transcription factors, the binding sites themselves are quite highly conserved. So it's not even as if it's the binding site. There have been very, very few studies where people have actually taken these transcription factors, take this transcription factor, which may have evolved, and determine what its DNA binding sequence specificity is and whether it's really different or not. So in some cases, we do have some examples where the actual binding site motif of the protein has changed and it has different specificity. In many cases, the binding site motifs are conserved, but the other parts of the protein evolve quite a bit. And of course, when these proteins sit on the DNA, they talk to one another. There's a lot of protein-protein interaction. And so perhaps it has more to do with protein-protein interaction and recruiting other proteins into this regulatory structure than it does just binding onto the DNA. But it's, you know, it seems like there's reasonable to think there's evolution in both components of the system. Or let's just say that's a question. How much is there in both?
Transcription factors that are doing a lot of other things as well. The DNA changing, DNA binding parts have a lot of extra effects which changing the binding of this transcription factor to another one may not.
We have an example in Drosophila of a specific instance where the transcription factor, it's good transcription factor, it has good well-characterized binding motif, but in this specific enhancer and binding site, the binding sequence doesn't matter at all. It never actually touches down on the DNA. It has to be there to regulate properly, but it assembles just from the protein-protein interactions with neighbors. So, you know, kind of buyer beware about these things, right? So anyway, I'm going to tell you about Evenskip. I you know, when I was young, I hated developmental biology, and but I've come really to love it. It's a beautiful, this early embryogenesis in Drosophila is really a beautiful system. The mother makes an egg, it gets fertilized, there's only a single cell, the cells start dividing, and in about 2.5 hours, it's set up a whole set of axes, so it knows where the head and tail and where everything is, and it does it through the expression of these kind of genes. This is the Eve pattern of expression. It produces these 7 stripes of expression. It's called pair rule, because actually the boundaries of these stripes will demarcate where alternating segments of the adult fly will be. This segmented organism, this has 14 segments, and these different. Now this is called even skip. There is an odd skip, and it just expresses right there. And there's another set, FUTs, that express one set of cells over, one set of cells over. So, once you have, say, half a dozen or so of these pair rule genes being expressed, each where the registration has been shifted a little bit, you have a pretty good specification system for where all the cells are. There's about 100 cells across in the embryo, and these stripes are about 4 cells wide. But there is, to a first approximation for all of these systems, one piece of regulatory sequence which drives the expression of one of these stripes. In some cases, you have one piece of regulatory DNA that drives 2 stripes, and those are quite interesting in their own right. But otherwise, sort of one piece of regulatory DNA drives 1 or 2 stripes, and so the even skip stripe 2 enhancer drives the even skipped gene to express in this row of cells, but not one over and not one over there, and nowhere else actually in the embryo if you isolate it. So it's turning a pretty neat trick in doing that. I mean, it's a very sophisticated piece of machinery to do that. These are quite highly sophisticated molecular switches. So to a first approximation, how does this work? Well, so I'm going to just talk about the anterior-posterior axis, so anterior posterior of the embryo. The mother supplies the embryo with some initial morphogens, both transcript and protein, and she supplies it only in one end of the embryo or the other end of the embryo. So that establishes the initial polarity, head to tail. And the key morphogen for setting up the anterior posterior axis is this gene up here, BCD, bicoid. And it is supplied in the interior of the embryo, and once it actually is sequestered, but once the embryo is fertilized, it's released, and it just creates a diffusion gradient. So one of the nice things about this system is that cells start dividing, but they don't form cell walls, just nuclei. And so there's no, all the communication that turn on and off genes, these transcription factors don't have to do any kind of second messenger signaling through cell membranes or anything like that. They just can directly migrate into the nucleus and bind to DNA. So it's established. So there's a diffusion gradient. It turns on hunchback. Hunchback is also supplied by the mother, but bicoid turns on hunchback, and together those things turn on a bunch of genes, about a half dozen key ones, that are expressed in broad anterior or posterior patterns. They're called gap genes because they're identified as genetic mutants. What is the gap? Well, where they're not expressing, you don't get the right kind of segments forming in big kind of gaps, the anterior half, the posterior half. And that's why they're called gap genes. Those then turn on pair rule genes, and the pair rule genes have this nice overlapping registration. These then turn on another set of genes called the segment polarity genes. Those are expressed in 14 stripe patterns, each one corresponding to specific segments. So it's this beautiful, and all these are transcription factors, just transcription factors, turning on transcription factors, turning on transcription factors. They don't have any real function other than to just create these landmarks. And it all works through diffusion up until the middle of this pair rule expression pattern when the cell walls form. And I'll show you a little bit about that. So very quickly, get a fertilized egg. The nuclei start dividing pretty much in the yolky center mass area. Yeah, they go through 14 semi-synchronous rounds of cell division or nuclear divisions, and at about between the 9th and 10th round of cell division, these nuclei start migrating to the periphery of the embryo or the egg. And these show time, 1 hour and 30. Here's 2 hours and 30. Pretty much all the nuclei have migrated to form this single monolayer of nuclei, at which point cell walls start forming. And they migrate from the exterior to the interior. And so there's about a 45-minute process here during which time these cell membranes form. And it's during this period of time when these pair-role genes, like even-skipped, form the beautiful stripe pattern. They begin expressing a little early as broad, fuzzy patterns, and then they sharpen and resolve to these beautiful stripes at kind of the mid-cellularization stage. One of the tricks of trying to do this work is that this process is very dynamic. Things are changing very, very quickly. But fortunately, we have these kind of landmarks that allow us to estimate the age of embryos that we're looking at in fixed embryos to maybe within about a 5-minute time window. And you need to do that to be able to do things. And once these cell walls form, then the embryo starts to invaginate, gastrulation starts, and then it becomes multicellular. But the other nice thing about this process is that up until this point, it's just a single monolayer of cells. And so one can look at it microscopically in some detail. So here's the even-skipped locus. It's actually about, the entire locus is about 18 kb. I show 16 kb here. So it doesn't have a particularly impressive coding region. It's a homeodomain protein. So, you know, it's a transcription factor. It has good homeodomain. It's part of the Hox cluster. We have it. Does the same thing in us as it does in the fly. Expresses anterior to posterior in embryogenesis and helps set up the kind of segmented features of our anatomy. These non-coding regions here are all the enhancers, the pieces of DNA, which if you just simply take this piece of DNA, hook it to a reporter gene like beta-galactosidase, it will drive a stripe coincident with the real stripe 2. So it's responsible for driving stripe 2. There's one that drives stripe 3-7 and downstream, one for 4-6 and another for 1-5. I think that's all I need to say about that. And if you home in on just the stripe 2 enhancer itself, this is about, 798 base pair piece of DNA. We think that contains the entire enhancer. One of the interesting things is the only way people can find enhancers, well, you can do phylogenetic shadowing and all kind of techniques, but experimentally what you do is you have this big piece of non-coding, you have the gene, the coding region, and they have non-coding regions upstream and downstream, and you just take a big piece of it, like let's take the 10 kb upstream region, hook it to a reporter gene, and see if it expresses the reporter gene in the same way as the native gene is. You see, oh, it produces stripes 2, 3, and 7. So you say, okay, that's there. And you just whittle down the piece of DNA, and you finally find a piece that just drives stripe 2, and then you found the enhancer. In fact, you can whittle this down to 460 base pairs, and it drives a nice stripe 2. Yet it's pretty clear that the entire structure of the enhancer is larger. And that in itself is an interesting observation. But there's 5 different transcription factors, bicoid and hunchback, which are required for activation of stripe 2, and then 3 repressors, cruple, giant, and sloppy paired, which make sure the gene stays off everywhere but stripe 2.
So was this all figured out after GFP, or a lot of it was figured out before that?
This was before GFP, actually. They were just use histochemical stains, but drive LAC-Z and just look for LAC-Z, immunohistochemical staining.
So these double enhancers, 1-5, for example, I'm kind of curious because to the extent that these things respond to morphogens, right, 1 and 5, therefore, have to be located at the same level of the morphogen, which, of course, it can't be, right? So I guess the question is, either these things are not truly reducible and 1-5 can be further split into 1 and 5, or they're really located at the some symmetric positions with respect to some of the upstream, maybe not the decoy, but a gap, other gap genes or something. So do we know that they are irreducible?
Yeah, they're irreducible. They're really irreducible. And in some cases, you have a gap gene that's expressed sort of in the middle of the embryo, right? So the gap gene has an anterior end where there's a nice gradient from high to low, and a posterior end of that thing where it's high to low. And that same enhancer binds those binding sites and takes advantage of both ends. So for the anterior stripe, that gap gene binding represses the posterior boundary. And for the posterior stripe, they use that same transcription factor that's expressed sort of in the middle of the embryo to repress the anterior boundary. And so it looks pretty clear to me that these things are evolved units that can take advantage of binding of a factor in more than one way. So, and there are some, it's not very well studied, but...
that one presumably can say something just at looking at the position. So for example, if 1-5 sort of symmetrically brackets whichever one...
whatever it is.
I forget. Then you immediately have a prediction that that's a major transcription factor regulating both. So is it true?
Right. Absolutely. And it's true. So that's been kind of demonstrated. But so anyway, this is the rough idea of how this piece of regulatory DNA makes just this stripe too. So here's anterior to posterior. You have these two broad anterior to posterior gradients in Bicoid and Hunchback. Those are activators. They turn on expression quite broadly. But for this enhancer, giant expression is anterior, Krupel is posterior. And so that enhancer, when it gets into this environment here, where there's a fair amount of Krupel, Krupel is binding to the enhancer and it shuts it down. And that's what creates the posterior border of the stripe. And similarly, anteriorly, once there's any appreciable amount of giant has binds to that enhancer and clamps it down, and that creates the anterior boundary stripes. And we know that you can knock out Krupel sites in the enhancer and you get posterior expansion. You can add extra copies of Krupel so that you broaden this thing and you narrow. So there's been all kind of good experimental kind of confirmation that this model is, to a first approximation, correct. Here's just a illustration that I'm meant to show too much. I'll show you a little more detail. Comparing some sequences between four species I'm going to talk about, Melanogaster, Yacuba, Erecta, and Pseudoobscura. We've heard a lot of talk about Pseudoobscura, but in any case, these three species, Mel, Yacuba, and Erecta, are all, I'll show you in more detail, but they're pretty closely related species. They're all part of the Melanogaster species subgroup. So they're just a single monophyletic clade of species closely related to Melanogaster. And then at some greater distance is Pseudoobscura. And Pseudoobscura is sort of like human to mouse type divergence.
And the three that are closer to it, what percent sequence different divergence are those?
For silent sites, for unconstrained regions, something in the 20% range. 25%. For synonymous, yeah. 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 So it is that much. They're not. But I'll also show you some stuff even more closely related. One of the interesting things, and we'll see it again, this is just these VISTA plots comparing. So here's, it's hard to see this, sorry about. This is the beginning of the coding region of the gene. So the coding region of the gene goes in this direction, and we're looking at the 5' non-coding region. And these little bars here are the stripe 2 enhancer, the stripe 3+7 enhancer, and there's another little enhancer called the autoregulatory enhancer up here, okay? And they're carried down in these little blue windows comparing alignments of Melanogaster sequence to Yacuba sequence, Melanogaster to Erecta sequence, and Melanogaster Pseudoobscura sequence, okay? So, and this is just the percent divergence in a sliding window. So this is completely conserved, and these things down here mean this is, I don't know what the scale is, but these regions down here mean that there's a lot of sequence divergence, okay? And actually, the point is that these enhancers don't actually stand out very much in the sea of the rest of the DNA all the way through. And these things do evolve. This is still quite a bit slower than synonymous sites, as I'll show you. But these enhancers, they perform this remarkable job. They do with great precision. That function is quite strongly conserved, although, as I'll show you, not completely at some level of detail. But the sequences diverge, and they diverge pretty much as these other regions that, to first approximation, don't have any known regulatory function, but must have some function because they're not evolving at such a fast rate.
How different is Sudarsky Rao from Madagascar? Can one tell the difference without a PhD in zoology?
They are visibly different looking from one another. But Melanogaster, Yakub, and Erecta look very, very similar. And they're hard to tell apart. Yeah, but Pseudo-Obscura is in an entirely different clade, and it's quite different. One nice thing about Drosophila is that the genome organization is quite strongly conserved. There are a lot of inversion differences, but sequences within a chromosome arm always stay in that arm. And when you look at the non-coding regions, so these are just a dot plot comparing a gene. This one is called DPP, comparing Virilis to Melanogaster. Now, Virilis is one of the far out groups of Drosophila. So these are very extensively diverged. And I never like to talk in terms of time, but maybe in terms of mutational hits per site for non-coding regions or for synonymous sites, this may be 1.5 or 2 hits per site already diverged. So this is quite broadly diverged. Here, this is a region 30,000 base pairs to 40,000 base pairs downstream from the DPP locus. And each one of these bloody little things are enhancers. They line up nicely along the diagonal there. They're evolving, but if you adjust the dot plot condition just right, you can pick them up out of the noise, and there they are. And the same is true for the Eve region. So if you home in now on the actual binding sites, so one of the nice things about Drosophila is that these binding sites have been physically mapped and characterized in great detail for a fair number of these enhancers. So we have quite good knowledge that this piece of DNA sequence, which I call the Krupel 6 site, binds a Krupel, and it matters. It's one of the functional sites that, is important for the stripe function. And the point is, you look here, you can see most of these sites have evolved differences. Some of them, for example, the BICOID 3 site is just not even present in some of these species. This was a site which was eliminated in one of those experiments I was telling you about, and you don't get a stripe 2. So it looks like it has evolved to become a functional site in Melanogaster. It's not present in the other species. Now, there may be a bunch of... So these are just all the sites known in Melanogaster and what the aligned sequences look like. There's obviously functional sites in the other species that we don't know about that have diverged to non-functionality in Melanogaster. So this is a kind of a biased view, which I'm going to tell you more about. But the point is that there is extensive evolution of binding sites. So the first experiments I'll tell you about was done using sort of a conventional approach, and that is to say you have a LAC-Z reporter, so it's going to drive LAC-Z expression, and you insert the non-coding DNA upstream, and you include the even skipped promoter and start of the protein coding region. You just fuse it to LAC-Z. So, and then upstream, we put in the Eve stripe too. So it's going to be able to talk to its own promoter, but drive LAC-Z expression. And we also, as a control, further upstream, we included a spacer region that is known to contain an insulator, because if you have two enhancers that are too close to one another, they interfere with one another. This guarantees they don't interfere, and that was experimentally shown. And we put in the 3-7 enhancer as well. It's just a control. And if you're going to muck around with this and put different species enhancers in, at least we can compare it to this.
Is it a crucial sequence with spacer, or basically just as...
Not actually known. Not actually known. You need, what they showed is that you need a certain length of it. And if you shorten it a little bit, then you start getting interference. Quite a bit is known about the nature of that interference. So these are embryos at just different stages in development. And these are transformed. These are permanent transformed flies that carry these genes. So this probably has the melanogaster stripe 2 enhancer and the melanogaster stripe 3-7 enhancer driving beta-galactosidase in one construct, just put somewhere in the genome in the fly, randomly inserted. And that's why, and these are double stained for both native even skipped protein in brown, these brown stripes, that's where the real even skipped is. And then in blue or purple, that's the beta-galactosidase. And you can, as you'll see, there's pretty nice coincident expression. So this kind of shows that these pieces of DNA drive those stripes in a quite precise way, right? And this shows it in much greater detail. This is an old experiment we published 10 years ago now, one of our first experiments, looking at melanogaster cupa erecta pseudo-obscura. And so we've just put in the stripe 2 enhancer from each of these four species. And you can see at a high level of resolution that all of those enhancers drive expression in with kind of perfect spatial fidelity. Right? So whatever those changes in the binding sites didn't affect the spatial fidelity of gene expression. Although it's quite apparent if you compare stripe 2 to stripe 3, the expression levels are pretty similar. And in some of these other species, the expression is quite weak relative to stripe 3. And that's something we observe quite commonly when you put these even skip enhancers in to melanogaster from other species. They tend to be weak. They often... So two things already here, that kind of the spatial pattern is maintained despite whatever the architectural evolution is, although the expression levels seem to be different.
But here you didn't do any cross-species engineering, like taking binding sites from this species, putting it to the other. This is like Eve's stripe 2 off Yakuba,
yes.
Off Erecta,
yes.
And off
yes.
Leg. Okay.
Yes, and I should say, I mean, that... I feel like for the rest of my career, I'm doomed to just repeating the same experiment again and again, doing it better each time. And we've always been reluctant to start playing around in too much detail and say, like, does this binding site matter? Or does that binding site? Because even when you compare closely related species, there's a lot of changes in the enhancer. And I think we've always felt it's a dangerous game to just make one change. Maybe it's just two bases in the spacing between a pair of binding sites and not the binding site sequence. We just don't know enough to have... Now we actually, there's some pretty good prediction modeling for these, how these enhancers work, and we have much more sophisticated techniques I'll show you about where we do it. But so these are really, yeah, just make the entire swaps. And what we've done is we've always started out with these kind of more distantly related species. We always, and there's always a question of the sensitivity of our assay as well. So, you know, we've just been bootstrapping our way along.
So does this mean that the levels of expression of the upstream gap genes are all invariant?
Well, you know, all of these are put in the exact same Drosophila melanogaster homozygous line. So these are all, you know, just... So these are not in the different species. These are all... putting right this enhancer, the Yakuba enhancer, into melanogaster and so.
Well, but
between the species, are they the same? We don't know. I'm going to argue that they're not, but I'll.
Well, so okay, I'm a little confused here. Right? So suppose level of Kruppel is 10 times higher in Pseudos obscura than it is in melanogaster.
Right.
Right. Therefore, if I transport that thing from pseudo obscura into melanogaster, I'll expect that it will express in the wrong place,
yeah.
Like where Kruppel is high or.
Yeah. You'll see. That's where I'm heading. Okay. But we don't know that for sure. But anyway, this is one of the problems with these kind of approaches, Bungish, no one ever does the experiments, for example, reciprocally. Because it would be nice if you put, the Yakuba enhancer into melanogaster and see how it expresses. It would be nice to take the melanogaster and put it in Yakuba.
It's not a problem, right? it's an interesting fact, right? So you know, the question is, but yeah. It is.
In truth, we really don't. We don't know.
On a level, there's also conservation, right?
And there's change, as well, and we know a little bit about it. So we did actually do some swap experiments, reciprocal experiments, where we took the melanogaster and put it into one species and took the other species and put it into melanogaster. But they're the only experiments I know of in existence. And this was one taking melanogaster and putting it into Virilis. So we took two distantly related. And what we did actually were promoter-enhancer swap experiments. So we made all the combinations of...
Can you just go back to the previous picture?
So this is some
difference that we're supposed to.
So first, I want to tell you that what I'm not showing are just the pictures of the native species by themselves. It might have been nice actually to have a Yacuba egg and a erect egg and a pseudobscure and just see what the patterns look. They all look the same. They all make these beautiful, nice seven stripe patterns. And
basically,
at
this level, it's not changing things. It's expressing in the right.
It's expressing in the right place, I would say, it's, but perhaps at different expression levels. That is what we would...
But how does it compare this difference between inter-melanogaster fluctuations? I mean, if you take two melanogaster, how much does it fluctuate the expression?
I'm going to show you this, that. Okay, that's one part of the talk. But so I'll go through this. So we were interested in whether there may be enhancer promoter coevolution. So one of the reasons the expression is weak is just because we've hooked it up to the wrong promoter. We take the virilis stripe to enhancer, but we're always using the melanogaster promoter. It has to talk to that promoter. So these are the experiments that we did those kind of swaps. So this just means melanogaster stripe to enhancer, melanogaster core promoter, and and we also have the stripe 3+7. And so I'm not going to worry about it. And it's always melanogaster in this experiment. Melanogaster stripe to enhancer, virilis core promoter. Here's the virilis stripe to enhancer, the virilis core promoter, right? And the other. So these are the four possible. And these are in melanogaster. So we've made these four possible enhancer promoter combinations, and we've put it back into Drosophila melanogaster. And you can see that, you know, if you have the melanogaster stripe 2 enhancer with its own core promoter, compare stripe 2 to stripe 3, you get a nice robust expression. If you take the melanogaster stripe 2 enhancer and put it to the virilis core promoter, you get a nice expression. So it doesn't seem to matter. There's no coevolution of the core. And the same thing is true. If you take the virilis stripe 2 enhancer with the melanogaster core promoter, you get weak expression, but in the right place. And if you take the virilis stripe 2 enhancer with its own core promoter, it's still weak when you put it in melanogaster. So no coevolution. And we did the reciprocal experiment. So now you can see these eggs look a little different because these are actually virilis eggs. We were able to transform virilis with these same things. And the upshot of this actually is that the melanogaster stripe 2 enhancer expresses quite robustly in virilis. So whereas the virilis enhancer is weak in melanogaster, the reciprocal is robust. And the virilis stripe 2 enhancer expresses robustly, which actually tells us that we probably have the whole enhancer, because there's always a question of whether the enhancer may have drifted or slid a little bit. But this actually probably is a good indication that, at least for the purposes of the experiment, we have a functional unit that can express strongly. So there is some asymmetry here in how these patterns express, maybe suggesting that there's been some directional evolution in one of those species, at least in the trans environment, such that the virilis now, when you put it in the melanogaster trans environment, doesn't express very well. The melanogaster enhancer is just plain strong. It's strong in its own environment. You put it in virilis, it's still nice and strong.
If you actually put the promoter in front of the gene itself rather than something which is a marker.
I'll tell you about that. As I say, we're doomed to repeating the same experiment we did. But then I'll just show you this one panel. This is really our claim to fame, a 2000 paper in which we made this chimera for the stripe 2 enhancer between melanogaster and pseudoobscura. So we took, it turned out, wasn't known at the time, but this sloppy pair binds at a single site right in the middle of the enhancer, and that is quite conserved, and it's completely conserved between melanogaster and pseudoobscura, just that binding site. So we made a reciprocal chimera that has the 5 prime half of the melanogaster enhancer and the 3 prime half of the pseudoobscure enhancer right at that conserved site, so we don't change any sequence. We're just swapping the halves. And we made the reciprocal as the pseudoobscure 5 prime half. So we have the 4 possible swaps here. And the net result is, so this is essentially, you've already seen, this is the melanogaster enhancer in melanogaster. Here's the pseudoobscure enhancer in melanogaster. And then this one shows, here's the chimer that has the melanogaster 5 prime half, pseudoobscure 3 prime half. And it doesn't function correctly. You get a broad stripe shifted so that it now expresses sort of in the interstripe region. This one is less obvious, but it's a broader pattern of expression as well. So neither of the two chimeras work properly when you put them together. And so we argued, it's not perfect argument, that it seems likely that there must be coevolution of binding sites or other features there in the 5 prime and 3 prime half, such that you need both of those evolved components to make them work properly. But when they do, they work the same way. So it looks like there's kind of coevolution of parts. This is consistent with this kind of binding site turnover model, where perhaps something is lost in the 5 prime half and gained in the 3 prime half, and you need those both halves to get that kind of compensation. And that's just, so we kind of argue that you could think of this maybe as a quantitative character, in the sense that the gene expresses over a set of cells. And we know we can make mutations because the geneticists did that expand the stripe a little bit, or you can shift it anterior a little bit, you can shift it posterior a little bit. So there's a lot of mutations that can play with that trait and shift it around. And selection is just trying to keep it there in the middle. But perhaps you can get mutations that just shift it maybe a tiny bit or barely at all. And then you can get compensatory changes that go back, and you have this. And this is really very much along the lines of what Vili was talking about in his model.
In the regulatory region rather than the transcription themselves.
Yeah, in the regulatory region, for sure. So and this just illustrates you can sort of either, depending on what happens, get directional selection, or you can get stabilizing selection and get one to outcome. So now I'll answer your question about, like, instead of using a reporter gene, what if you actually drive the gene itself? And so we spent quite a Misha doing this experiment. It's a truly beautiful, heroic experiment. Can be done much more easily now, but even though it was only done, we only published it 3 or 4 years ago. So what he did is, starting with the entire even skip locus, right? What he did was he removed the stripe 2 enhancer and created a fly that, so what we did is, he did this in the test tube and he put it back in the fly. So now you have an whole Eve locus but missing a stripe 2 enhancer, and we crossed it to a mutant that knocks out the native locus. So now all Eve functions are being driven by the gene we put in, which doesn't have a stripe 2 enhancer. So it doesn't make a stripe 2. So it's sort of a 6-stripe fly. Actually, there is a little weak, what looks like a little weak expression in the stripe 2 region. And no one really knows where that comes from. One concern was that we chopped out the core of the stripe 2 enhancer. Maybe the pieces we put together sort of created a little enhancer that sort of works. But we know that's not the case. And no one knows what that stripe is. And in fact, even before we got this paper published, there were 2 papers published about this observation because we had talked about it, and we gave up this thing. But to a first approximation, it doesn't make a stripe. And I can tell you, this embryo is lethal.
Before the pair, perils things start coming in. And
what happens? The cute thing about Drosophila, these embryos, is that these don't die quickly. It just, because the mother provisions the embryo with everything it needs, basically, and it just chugs through embryogenesis until it makes a larva, and that's when they die. So even if you kill it 10 times over by removing bicoid or, you know, any of these things, they'll keep trying to make a, you know, larva, and they kind of peter out right at the end of the, this embryonic stage. But so, yes, I'm going to show you that. In fact, I had that slide and I removed it. But so one prediction is, if this doesn't make a stripe 2, it shouldn't turn on the next set of genes, right? And I'll show you that's exactly what happens. They don't. So this, it doesn't turn it on, and it's lethal. So, yeah.
I realize I don't understand very well what these different enhancers do. So why do we need different enhancers to turn on the same gene in different places? So it's the, so there's yeah. one, if I understand, there's one gene, right, and you want to turn it on in several places. So why do we need a different enhancer for each place?
Yeah. You know, I think it just has to do with there is a limited number of these signals of the gap genes that are expressed in these broad patterns. So BCOID is expressed as a gradient at the anterior of the embryo. Once you get towards the posterior of the embryo, the gradient is so shallow that it has no information content in telling you whether you're at the 80th to 84th cell or the 84th to 88th. And that's the reason. So each of these enhancers draws on previously expressed transcription factors that have nice sharp gradients in the regions where they want to be able to, you know, turn on and turn off a gene. So they take advantage of the kind of maximal information content in the things that are available to be able to create these sharp boundaries. And, you know, nature hasn't... They have designed these pairs of enhancers that drive pairs of stripes, but not beyond that. So anyway, so what we did, the experiment we did then was to, in a fly that doesn't make a stripe 2, we then took the stripe 2 enhancer, and instead of putting it to LAC-Z, we hooked it up to the EVE gene itself. So now this is going to topically express a stripe 2. And now when we bang these together by crossing them, we can ask whether or not the expression of this enhancer actually rescues the lethality produced by this. So we can actually look at the biology and the viability, actually measure. And I'll show you the viability measurement. So these are the four species, same four players. These are the enhancers. The enhancers are not all the same size. They change their size a little bit. But one nice thing is there's some nice conserved little bits of DNA off either end of the enhancer and in all these species. And so all these enhancers stop and start at exactly the same orthologous place. We're very confident of that. But they're slightly different sizes.
Why is the spacing matter that much? You know, it's a couple of kilobase.
Spacing?
Away, so why does a couple of base pairs matter?
You know, we haven't investigated yet, but, you know, there are studies that show that because there's cooperative binding of these transcription factors, and if you just move them a couple of bases apart, it can matter. And in fact, they may have a lot to do with the fine-tuning, but also the directional evolution. Because one of the interesting things about these enhancers are, you see, some of them are larger than others. But generally, the length of these enhancers are also differences, are characteristic of the genome in general. It's quite interesting. But, you know, the pseudo-obscure genome is 30% bigger in length than the melanogaster one, and most of the enhancers are about 30% length. So genome-wide stretching, as if maybe there's been some slight change in the insertion-deletion bias or some such thing, such that you get quite uniform shifting. It's not that there's been a particular transposable element that's rapidly multiplied and you have this massive expansion of heterochromatin or something like that. So... So maybe those things happen. Now, when you do stretch these things apart, perhaps you need binding sites that are stronger or shifted slightly to compensate that. But it's something that has not been investigated in detail. But something we know we can do now because we've moved a generation beyond this kind of level of sophistication. We have really beautifully sensitive systems now that we can investigate. So now we feel experimentally we're in a position we can make single changes and study the very detail differences.
Yeah, the pressures to keep the genome size, selective pressures to keep the genome size down may differ also.
It may differ also, that's right. And, you know, it may just be a drift thing or whatever. They don't differ by a lot. The genome size in Drosophila is very compact, and it is in all these species. But they do differ by as much as a factor of almost 2 between the smallest and the largest. Most of these are 20-30% difference, things like that. This just shows that when you take those enhancers, these are driving even skipped, and we cross them into a fly that doesn't make any even skipped. So the only even skipped is coming from this construct. They all make stripe twos. So we want to see whether these can rescue the fly that doesn't make a stripe two. So the crossing design, there's a little more to it, and I probably should skip it, but so what we've done is we've put in an experimental Eve locus missing a stripe two on a chromosome in which we've knocked out the whole Eve locus, so all the Eve functions are coming from this, and we carry it over what's called a balancer chromosome that has curly wings, a dominant curly wing, and it has a good Eve locus. And then on a I call this the rescue transgene. It makes a stripe 2 Eve, and we want to know whether it rescues. We selected flies where it inserted on the third chromosome, and it's carried over another balancer that has a Bissell mutation, dominant Bissell mutation, we can tell. And so that's actually what these things look like. And the experiment I tell you about, we actually cross two different strains that carry two different insertion of this Eve rescue transgene. And the reason is that we now have a more sophisticated system in Drosophila. We don't have to worry about this, but this is standard P element transgenics. They hop randomly into a chromosome, and of course if this happened to have hopped into a gene, this may not be able to rescue the lethality, but not because it doesn't work, but because it knocked out a gene that kills the fly. So we want to try to avoid that, and so we take flies that are in two different places on that chromosome and cross them. Generally, that kind of lethality is recessive. And it turns out, by this crossing scheme, we can actually test for that effect in any case. Because the class we're really interested in are these class of offspring that have, in both of the chromosomes, carry this Eve that doesn't make a stripe 2 and doesn't make its own Eve. And then we can look at things that have one copy or two copies of the transgene present. But they're not truly allelic in the same place in the chromosome. They're in different places. But we can also look at these in flies that make a good Eve locus. And so those flies are viable. But if there's any lethality caused by where these hopped in, we can see it in these as well. So the full experimental design is to sort of take a particular strain that has in one place and take a different strain that has that rescue in a different place, cross it to itself, and look at the whole. These are the four different classes that can come out, just separated by male and female, and you get these kind of numbers. And you expect a 4:2 to 2:1 ratio. So we actually can estimate the viability, the relative viability of these different transgene, okay? And you can see, like in this case, this has a good Eve locus, but it has, we expect a 2:1 ratio here if there's no lethal effect of where it hopped in the genome. And you can see this beautiful 2:1 ratio. For that one, for this one, 17:500, it looks like there's, when you have two copies, it does have a slightly deleterious effect on its own. But in this kind of heterozygote combination where they're in different places, this very nice 2:1 ratio. So we knew that. That avoids that. So we're able to estimate relative viability. And this is the result of the experiment. It was really quite a beautiful result. So we could look at just one copy or two copy of the transgene. It's sort of like just a heterozygote that only has one copy, or a homozygote that has two copies, but the homozygote, it's in two different places. So one or two copies in this kind of blue and purple. Here's the melanogaster control. We put the melanogaster gene in, and this is rescue percent. Here's the pseudo-obscura, and this, here's kind of a depiction of the phylogeny. So pseudo-obscura is most distantly related, one copy, two copy, and you can't really see across, but if you look across, they're absolutely identical. So it looks like the pseudo-obscura enhancer rescues exactly as well in both one copy and two copies as the melanogaster. The much more closely related species, Erecta, that enhancer doesn't work at all. It's completely dead. We analyzed multiple transformants and did all the proper controls. It simply doesn't turn on enough in melanogaster to actually rescue lethality, and these things are completely lethal. And the Yakuba actually, in two copies, rescues quite robustly, but one copy does not, only about one third. So it looks like you have a combination of maybe convergence in some sense, so that whatever the reason, this one that's more distantly related, and at the sequence level much more diverse, actually works perfectly. Now all these flies make beautiful seven stripes, and they make their own nice stripe too, driven by this same enhancer, no doubt. But this most evolved one works exactly as melanogaster does. This one not at all, and this one sort of intermediate.
But are these transcription factors used later on?
They are.
Back in things,
they are.
Yeah. So it's presumably it can be pressure coming from different needs for the transcription factors later on, which then feeds back into here.
Could be. Of those trans factors, absolutely. Absolutely. And we don't really have the answer, I mean, at the finest level of resolution we'd like. Maybe in the next generation of experiments we'll start getting there.
But you're examples of transcription factors at these early stages which you understood which aren't used later on? Or are they basically everything is used?
Everything is used. All those genes that get turned on early get used later, actually. But you were asking about, you know, what happens, do they not be able to turn on the next set of genes? And this is actually showing that. So even skip is required for driving the expression of engrailed. And engrailed is one of these 14 stripe patterns. So it's just the next stage in development. And this just shows that in this fly that's missing a stripe 2 enhancer, there instead of getting this nice stripe 4, there's this nice even spacing of stripes. So here's stripe 4. You get this basically no stripes, something like that. And here's the Drosophila erecta construct. It looks sort of just like losing this stripe. Neither of those make an engrailed stripe 4. And both of these are embryonic lethals when homozygous. But conversely, if you look at the pseudo-obscura one or the Yakuba, when you have two copies, they make nice stripe 4s. So Eve stripe 2 turns on engrailed stripe 4. Who is required for the expression. And actually, it was kind of interesting that Yakuba 1 copy, which had, we got some flies coming out, but not that many. It makes a stripe 4, but you can see it's in not all embryos, but enough that you can see it. They're displaced a little bit, not quite normal. So there's a very good correlation between the two. And we actually showed the reason erecta doesn't work is it just doesn't express in 0, 1, and 2 copies. It does. I showed you the picture of the erecta stripe 2. It makes a stripe, but it's very, very weak. So the picture is a little deceptive. We just exposed it for long enough till we finally got it to be able to see the stripe. But the expression level is very, very low. Not enough to turn on the engrailed stripe. Okay. And this just goes to show, and I can get around it, that perhaps there has been some shift in these upstream transcription factors or their concentrations or gradients that are important. So this just shows the classic experiment in Drosophila melanogaster. If you take bicoid and you add extra doses to the fly, because one of the key predictions of bicoid being the critical morphogen that sets up the AP axis, if you add more copies of bicoid, you get more bicoid, and so this concentration gradient should sort of shift posteriorly, and you should get stripes forming more and more posteriorly, and that's actually just what happens. Everything shifts posteriorly when you add bicoid doses. So it's an important experiment establishing that.
Are this one of the ones that recovers from this later on?
They do, actually. You don't get many. These are not happy flies, but you can get some flies out. Now this as is actually looking at an erecta embryo. This is not a melanogaster embryo. This is the melanogaster embryo. This is an erecta embryo. And you see they make nice stripes. And it has a nice robust stripe too. But it's just showing that as a percentage of the egg length, they are pushed posteriorly somewhat. And so perhaps there has been some shift in the morphogen gradients. And now when you take this enhancer and put it in melanogaster, perhaps it's evolved to have adjusted to a slightly different kind of morphogen gradient environment so that it just doesn't express properly in the landing. I don't know. This is conjecture, but I'm going to show you some more of those. So just, you know, summary of this stuff is that spatial patterning is conserved, the expression level varies, we see evidence for compensatory evolution, and has capacity to rapidly functionally evolve in kind of a directional way. Okay. So both Ilya Ravinsky's experiments and these experiments are consistent in some sense. These maybe show that the evolution can happen pretty rapidly. And there's, at the level of the enhancer architecture, there's been some directional evolution. Maybe we should take a break now. This will work out. Then I have the next two won't take as long. This is talk about two more subjects, and this segment now actually is relevant to what Vili talked about yesterday, because it's actually an attempt to look at binding site sequences and their evolution in a sort of constrained setting. And this is a work in progress by a graduate student, Bin He. Like the Stripe 2 enhancer, it's very well characterized both genetically and physically. And for that enhancer, I think, you know, you can believe me at this point that we really know where a lot of those binding sites are, both by footprinting and manipulation. Well, there's quite a number of genetic loci and enhancers that have been characterized similarly, perhaps not quite to the extent of the Stripe 2 enhancer. For which we can take what I like to think of as a golden set of transcription factor binding sites, because they're not predicted from a position weight matrix or predicted based on some sequence motif, but these are actually a set that have been physically footprinted and characterized. And there's a database of those footprint sites. It was initially assembled by a former student of mine, Casey Bergman, and he maintains these databases. So we Bin took 146 non-coding regions with enhancers. Maybe it's about 100 different genes. So it might include the EVE Stripe 2 enhancer and the EVE 3.7 enhancer, but 146 different. And he looked at, and those 146 regions had 789 footprinted sites, so kind of physically characterized sites. They bind to 30 different transcription factors with available PWMs. There's more than that in the database, but we restricted our attention to ones for which there were transcription factors that had a reasonably well kind of established PWM. That PWM is position weight matrix. It's just, I'll show you a little bit more, but it is a way of characterizing what the sequence requirement and degeneracy is for binding. And we restricted attention to things that only perfectly align between Drosophila melanogaster and Drosophila simulans, and actually as well as an outgroup, Yacuba. So male and sim are these closely related species. They're about actually 10% diverged at the synonymous sequence level, but only maybe about, I'll show you, 2% or so diverged in these non-coding regions, and we only looked at things that could perfectly align through these footprinted sites. So it turned out, so no gaps or anything like that. And we then focus on what amount were 170 binding sites that had nucleotide substitutions in them. 56 turned of them we could assign to the melanogaster lineage, and 57 to the simulans lineage, as I'll show you, because we had an outgroup.
So does footprinted mean you made experiments or you found them with a PWM? Yes.
No, experiments. And we didn't do the experiment, but someone actually did a DNA protection assay to physically identify the region of DNA. And we took those DNAs and we realigned them and re-extracted PWMs and identified what the motifs were that we would analyze here.
But there were only 30 PWMs, so only for 30 of these 700-something footprinted genes you get a PWM.
Well, there are 789 footprinted sites.
Oh.
And
they comprise.
So there's multiple ones for, you know, individual transcription factors. So in total, we're looking at 30 different transcription factors. But it's a very heterogeneous collection of substitutions that we're looking at. Many different enhancers for many different genes with many different transcription factors. And there's some overlap, you know, maybe of those 179, there are 20 of them that have Bicoid sites in them, but others. So quite. So we weren't sure that we would see any pattern emerge from such a heterogeneous collection, but the question is, you know, what? How good a pattern? Really showed one transcription factor genome-wide and how it behaved, and this is sort of a analog of that, but we were trying to gain power by looking across different transcription factors, so one might expect to see more heterogeneity. I'll jump back, but so essentially what we have are melanogaster simulants, and we have Yacouba sequence for all these as an outgroup, so in many cases we can polarize the changes, and we're only going to look at those sites for which we can polarize the mutational change. So we know at this enhancer there's a difference between male and sim, and we have a good alignment from Yacouba where we can say, oh, Yacouba has such and such. It's retained in this lineage, so the mutation must have occurred in simulants. And in cases where we couldn't root the change because maybe there was a different sequence in Yacouba, we're not including those in the analysis. So I'll just go back very quickly. This doesn't really show up, but just to show. This is just the analysis is. Yeah, I'll tell you the numbers. I'm not gonna focus on this.
This violates rule number 3 of PowerPoint.
Yeah. but so we're just looking on the evolution on the melanogaster lineage or on the simulans lineage, and I'll just tell you the numbers here. This says synonymous, and 7%, 5%. There's about 12% net divergence between male and sim for synonymous changes. Transcription factor binding sites, 1%, 1%. So the transcription factors are evolving, you know, maybe only at 20% the rate of synonymous sites. So there's clear constraint there. And these are binding sites, I say, that are, you know, ascertained in melanogaster and compared between melanogaster. And this is the whole enhancer, 1.5%, 1.1%. So actually, you know, if you go back to those pictures I've shown you of the binding sites and the spacers between the binding sites, there's more spacer region than there is binding sites, but the whole region is not evolving much faster than the binding sites. So it's interesting. There's a lot. There's just unknown functionality in those regions. That's all you can say. They're constrained.
The spacer sequence matters. It's not just the length.
That's right. It's not just the length. It is the space. And it's really surprising because I just, for a long time, resisted believing that.
Presumably things that favor various loopings and other things.
You know, I don't even want to talk about it, but it's.
Yeah.
But there's other things. I think it's a lot of selection to avoid sequences that could bind a transcription factor that may interfere. So this is the basic experiment. So we're going to focus on these 117 that, you know, are well changes that are well behaved. And this is one such change for this transcription factor DEAF1. And so here, melanogaster has a T at this position, and simulans has a C at that position. And Yacouba has a T at this position. So it looks like there's a mutation from a T to a C. And if we go into the position weight matrix and look at position 10, this is position 10 in the kind of core motif, you can, these are just kind of log transforms of the base frequencies. So there's A, C, G, T, four possible bases at this position. And this is a log score of the base frequency, essentially. And as kind of Willie was alluding, there's kind of a statistical theory that argues that you can take these frequency scores and kind of convert them to binding energy. And so what we're trying to imagine we're approximating is the binding energy difference between the T and the C. So the question is, there's a change. How much has it weakened or strengthened the binding of that site to the transcription factor. And so in this case, the C is minus 2.82, the T is minus 0.56. We subtract one from the other, and the net change is minus 2.26. Okay? So in...
Why is there a positive for G? I mean, if it's a log of a frequency.
Oh.
Or is that minus?
Yeah, it should probably be a minus there. Yeah, sorry. So that's the approach. I just want to...
This conservation in the Holy Land, has anybody tried to take two nodes and put in the middle of something random, like and see how the expression, if there's any phenotype of the expression?
I don't know of such experiments. Definitely. It's kind of a tricky business. Because you say, okay, let's put something random, but those random sequences, because of the degeneracy of these binding sites, you may actually be putting in a cryptic binding site. It's actually a hard experiment.
Random, and then, for example, you try to avoid binding sites for factors and see if there's
any right. Yeah. All I can say is, you know, we've been reluctant to do it with the systems we've had. We think we now have a system where, you know, we have enough sensitivity where we can try those things, and so we have them in the card. So I just want to show you. There's always, so we're looking at these changes between MEL and SIM, and we're applying the PWM was built based on melanogaster sequence. There might be a slightly different binding specificity in simulins, and there's biases in these assembly of these PWMs. This just shows for the subset of factors for which we could do this. There's another method for there's kind of two ways to establish these PWMs. One, you just take all the instances of known binding sites in or predicted binding sites from a sequence, align them all, and just get what the frequencies are. You can also do it by something called CELEX, in which you synthesize random oligonucleotides, feed them to the transcription factor, and see what binds. And so this is a completely independent method, and this just shows for these. So these are maybe for three or four or six, I can't remember, of those transcription factors and data. And so these are scores of plus one or greater or minus one and greater, the net change. So they're increasing by the two different methods. And actually, the analysis I'm going to tell you about only focuses on ones where the net change is one or greater. Because again, we sort of kept whittling down the data set. Because from these PWMs, you can predict a binding energy change. But if it's small, the prediction we know is very, very poor. So we said, let's just focus on ones that exceed a certain threshold where we're maybe more confident that, you know, if it says it's increased the binding strength, we have some reason to believe that that might be true. And this shows there's pretty good correspondence between the two. For example, by the footprinting method, for all the sites that were minus one or greater, there were a few of them by the other method that had them as weak, but there's only a single site that had it as positive. For this set, there's a couple that had it as weak, but none that had it strong in the other direction. So we're just going to focus on sets of the subset of changes that are fairly strong.
What are the units? I mean, what does one mean as far as the binding?
Oh, I don't know. It's, you know, I say it's really just this log transform of the frequencies subtracted from one another. So,
okay.
I don't actually. But so anyway, we're looking. So this is the result, and I violated rule three again, almost, but saved the day because the only thing that matters are these red ones. And so here are the. So it turned out. So of those 117, there turned out. So we're looking at changes that have occurred on the MEL lineage and changes that occur on the SIM lineage. And there turn out to be 26 plus 8, 34 of them on the melanogaster lineage and 36 of them on the simulant. So almost an equal number. But these are ones that are positive, which is saying increasing binding strength, and these are negative. They're decreasing binding strength. And you can see if you look on the simulants, so these are sites that were ascertained to be functional sites in melanogaster. If there's a change in them that sort of at least exceeds one, 35 out of 36 are always decreasing the binary energy. They only go in one direction. And say, if you have a change, it's taking that site and decreasing its strength. And you see the opposite in melanogaster. So there are, of those changes, many of those sites were weak sites in the ancestor. They mutated to become stronger sites in melanogaster. And there's this strong asymmetry, not as strong as the loss in simulans, but 26 to 8 in melanogaster. So this is just about what you'd probably expect, or really might expect on this binding site turnover. We've ascertained these sites because they exist in melanogaster. They're functional. And if there's mutations, there's some that make them kind of more functional. And most of them are ones that make them more functional in melanogaster. They've evolved to become good sites. But in simulans, they sort of almost always go in the other direction. There's a large mutational pressure that can make them weaker. And they must get compensated somewhere else. Because we don't...
Many different transcription factors.
And these are many different transcription factors. So this is one of the first conclusions. It's really interesting that despite the fact we're looking at many different enhancers for many different genes and 30 different transcription factors, they all are doing exactly the same thing in terms of how they're evolving.
And these things were all discovered in melanogaster.
Not really.
Yeah,
well, anyway,
so close to you,
they aren't very close. That's why we restrict our attention to close ones. We've looked at the actual protein sequences for all the 30 transcription factors. All of them are absolutely identical in the DNA binding domains, and all of them have a couple of differences or, you know, none in other places in the protein, but they're completely clear. But the hope was that by just restricting to very closely related species, the transcription factors are doing the same thing, and these PWMs and the assignment of changes is going to be, you know, reasonably intact. Bin is actually is doing some of his work in Switzerland with this guy, Sebastian Merkel, who worked in Steve Quake's lab, developing this microfluidic device to measure binding energy. We can actually measure binding energies and do it for transcription factor in different species. But anyway, there's this tremendous asymmetry. Part of the reason we see the asymmetry, well, I mean, this is saying that of these all these kind of sites that we kind of know exist in melanogaster, and almost all of them are likely to be important and functional, they're only going in one direction in simulans, and that's downhill. And so if all of these enhancers are still functional in simulans, they must be compensated by the evolution of new sites somewhere else in simulans that may not be present in melanogaster. We're just looking at this by a set.
But if you look at these mutations, just if you do like 4x4 matrix of like A goes to C and G, does it then look it's symmetric? So is there like a new process that would give you...
I haven't looked at that. Yeah, it'd be worth looking at. So perhaps I shouldn't have been so surprised, but the magnitude of the asymmetry was really quite startling. And in total, about 10% of the sites in Mel and Sim have actually sustained a mutation. This is just a subset. I don't want to dwell on this. So it's obvious that there must be sites in simulant sequence that are binding sites in simulants that are not present in melanogaster, so we're not analyzing them because we're only looking at the male ascertained set. So we did a lot of binding site prediction to try to find those sites, and we could find them. One thing this is showing
are the temperatures, optimal temperatures of development and the speed of the development roughly the same?
Yes. Yeah, these species are actually so close that you cannot tell them apart morphologically. The females you absolutely cannot. The males, there's some little subtle differences in the male genitalia. And they're both garbage species. They have
same
very, very similar distributions of climates. Yeah, they're actually ecologically quite similar. Some of the other species are not, but these two actually are. I just wanted to show that so this is kind of doing binding site prediction and looking for sites that are only in male, shown in red, and only in sim in yellow. And actually, these are the regions, the enhancer regions that in melanogaster were shown to be responsible for driving the regulation of something. And if you focus on those regions, there's actually quite a number of them where, you know, you can where there still is asymmetry. You're doing binding site prediction, and you hope to find simulant-specific sites that are not present in melanogaster. So you kind of get a balance too. And these are ones that are sites that are shared in both species. But there's quite a number of them where you can't find kind of enough of the simulant sites, or any, even if you do the binding site prediction. But if you expand your search by a couple of hundred bases on either side of that enhancer region, then you can find more of those sites. So here's an example where within the region defined in melanogaster to contain the enhancer, you don't find any sim-specific sites, but if you expand the search a couple hundred bases on either side, you start picking them up. So perhaps there's some enhancer spreading. And this just speaks to the issue in analyzing these kind of data. It's a bit of a risky business how you do it, because it's possible that, you know, these are nice, closely related, beautiful alignment of sequence, everything like that, but maybe the enhancer's sliding a little bit. And you don't really know how far to look. But perhaps this is an indication of that. I don't know that it is. But I'm just going to finish, and I don't even want to explain it too well, but if you can see down here, this is what we originally showed you in this asymmetry. So the white means binding energy is decreasing, and the black or the colored gray is increasing. And this was the DMEL, DSIM footprinted sites. So I showed you virtually all the changes. And this is actually just for Hunchback, because this is going to include binding site prediction. And we chose Hunchback because it's extremely well characterized, the position weight matrix. So that's why there's just not so many. But all the sites that changed are decreasing in Simulans lineage. Most of them are increasing in the melanogaster lineage. If you do binding site prediction, predicted sites in melanogaster only, they just look at the melanogaster. So now you should, and we looked at the sensitivity and specificity and picked a good threshold value, because you can play those off. You can find additional sites in melanogaster that weren't footprinted. Footprinted sites are not necessarily all the sites. But you still get the same pattern. There are more sites, but if there's a change in any of them, they tend to decrease. So perhaps it's an indication that there are more functional sites in melanogaster. And most of them are increasing in melanogaster. Here's predicted sites in simulans. So now we'd take the simulan sequence, try to predict sites in simulans, and you get the exact opposite pattern. So now in simulans, if there's a change, so you're predicting a site in simulans, you're now aligning it to the melanogaster sequence. If there's a change, they're mostly increasing on the simulans lineage. So these are the hidden sites in simulans that have gone from being a weak site that wasn't footprinted in melanogaster to a strong site or a stronger site in simulans. So these are the kind of hidden compensating sites. But if you sum these together, they still don't quite add up. So there's still kind of a much bigger tail of sites that are decreasing in the simulans lineage than increasing in it. I'm just going to leave it at that. That at this point, we don't know whether these things really sum to a zero kind of net sum game. That's what we'd like to know. When Bin goes and actually, so he's going to do is take all these evolved differences and polymorphism data as well, and actually measure binding energies. And he's also going to do it by just arraying across Hold enhancers so we can find everything. And we're going to try to look at it more carefully. But there's perhaps a hint here that there may be some net flow towards having more good binding sites in melanogaster than in simulans for these set of enhancers. But perhaps not. This is where it stands at this point. But it was very illuminating to me just to kind of go through this exercise and see these biases and things. So that just summarizes what I've just said. Okay, for the last 30 minutes, this is going to work out perfectly. I'm going to tell you about variation evolution pattern formation. So now we're going to ask, not whether the enhancer works, but we're not going to focus specifically on the enhancers, but we're just going to look at the stripe phenotype itself. Do flies put their stripes in the same place or not? And if they do, how robustly do they do it? and we're going to look at within and between species. And all this work was done, well, I shouldn't say all, it was with a collaboration with Misha Ludwig and Susan Lopp, but it became her thesis. And so she did the bulk of this work. So we wanted to ask whether flies put their stripes in the same place, and we decided we would focus on embryos that differ in egg size or egg length. And this just because I was telling you that these diffusion gradients are established, and it's the diffusion gradients that dictate where these enhancers fire. And so length has to be a challenge in some way to how robustly these things work. So although it is already known by, from Vishals, and that was one of the first things he looked at, he didn't look at genetic variation or genetic differences for embryo size, but just, you know, any old female doesn't always lay eggs the same size, so there's some just environmental noise, developmental noise in egg size. And they showed there's a nice scaling of this property. But so we're kind of looking at the scaling issue. But this just shows a bunch of different species. They make eggs of various different sizes. Actually, it's interesting. Some species make big eggs, but you can see the big eggs are all about the same size of bigness. And perhaps we have a clue to that now because we've looked quite carefully. They go through 14 rounds of cell division, and then the cells migrate up to form this monolayer of cells. Small embryos don't use all of those cells, and they leave a bunch of them behind in the middle. The big ones use all of them, every last one. And so perhaps there's a constraint, a real developmental constraint on how big these fly embryos can be if they only go through 14 cell divisions. But in any case, we decided within Drosophila melanogaster, we would focus on some strains. We just searched, you know, strains that make a big egg and make a small egg. So India and France, those were just flies that were collected from there, and they just turn out to make, you know, and it's genetic, good genetic difference. So you can see there's quite a bit of variation within a species. And this is adaptive, undoubtedly, because there are beautiful clines in egg size with latitude and altitudinally in Drosophila. And all the continents have the same latitudinal cline. And you see it across species, in fact, across all insects that lay eggs. Bigger eggs as you get to colder climates. And as far as I know, no one has a clue why that is. It's just, I'm sure there's a named rule. You know, it's someone's rule that eggs get bigger when you go north. And so it is here. It's also the case that...
I'm confused. Yours are bigger in India than France.
Oh, yeah. I didn't say what part of India, though. Or what part of France. So actually... but I'm just telling you that in general, there's a lot of variation. But there are these nice, well-established clines. And I can tell you, if you just take... we can go outside here to the garbage cans and fruit market, collect Drosophila melanogaster. There'll be plenty of polymorphic, or to the winery or something. If you take them into the lab as a mixed population where there's genetic variability, just split up your sample and then grow them for 2 years at 25 degrees and 17 degrees, they will evolve egg size differences just by themselves. So that's a chemostat experiment for flies, really. Okay. And I have a postdoc that's just completed an artificial selection experiment, which he actually artificially selected for large and small eggs, and we're looking at those, but I don't have anything to report yet. But so we chose large and small. And then we also compared Simulin strain and Seychellia strain. Now, I've already talked about Simulins as being, you know, a relatively close relative. Seychellia is an island endemic, only found in the Seychelles Islands. It's virtually not diverged at all from Simulins. That is to say, if you take the average locus and sequence some Simulins and sequence Seychellia, there is no net sequence divergence between them, essentially zero, a small fraction of 1% at most. But they have some ecological differences, and there's clearly some bulk changes. The other thing is Seychellia is almost certainly a beautiful example of a bottleneck speciation event because there's virtually no genetic variability in Seychellia, just exceedingly low levels of polymorphism. So there may have been a single fertilized female that wafted over to the Seychelles and eventually founded a new species. But there's very, very little divergence. But as luck would have it, we have kind of small and large egg within melanogaster and a small and large egg between species. So we could look at both and actually So there they are. So those are the comparisons we're making. This to that and this to that. Okay?
What's in the room? Is that the colder? The larger?
Eggs get larger, yeah. So.
And develop more slowly.
And they develop more slowly. That's right. So, yeah, so, I mean, we have some ideas, and but there hasn't been a lot of work done on this. It's a nice, it's a really nice trait to work on.
The shell is supposed to be
warm.
Yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely. But different species have different egg sizes, and Seychellia has just, and there's no very genetic variability, and it only lives in one climate, and for whatever reason, it has a very small number of ovarioles, and it makes about as big an egg as it could make, for reasons totally unknown. Just I don't know. It's misinformed. So what Susan did was measure Eve stripe boundaries, and she also did it for giant and cruple. So we have two gap genes where she can measure stripe boundaries, and stripe boundaries here. I had a postdoc who I directed to try to write a program to be able to find the stripe boundaries in the data, and we got a program to work okay. It probably needed a little more tweaking. It worked actually reasonably well. Susan wanted to just check how well the program worked. So we had a program. It would find the stripes. It would kind of estimate a curve, and we could overlay it on the actual embryo again, and visually they look really nice. Susan said, well, let me just measure some by hand to just make sure, see how they compare. And she got the same answers where the stripes were, but her variances were lower than our prediction. And she didn't want to wait. And in fact, her errors were so small. And it turns out, it just doesn't take that much work to do. So you kind of hand estimate. So you're just measuring along the AP axis where these stripes are relative to the length of the embryo. Those are the measurements. And I'll show you. You also have to be very careful about staging these embryos, what developmental stage they're at, because the stripes move with age. So just shows that we try to carefully stage the embryos and take that in as a covariate in the analysis, which reduces some of the variance. There's a little bit of a complicated plot. Let me just, before you try to figure this out, let me just explain the axes, okay? Well, this is obvious, Eve's stripe number. So for each stripe, there's actually an anterior and posterior, anterior, posterior, anterior, posterior borders, okay? And then on this axis, what we actually have is these percent embryo length relative to the mean of the entire experiment, because we did this as one big experiment, so we could keep all the incubators and everything the same, and all the fixation procedures. So we did it as one big experiment, and it just turned out it displays the data in a nice way. So these are kind of deviations from the mean, and this, if when things are up here, means that stripes are pushed more posteriorly, and things that are below the mean mean stripes are pushed more anteriorly, just compared to the overall mean of the experiment. And it contains both within species, France and India. There's a third melanogaster strain. This is a laboratory strain that we use as a control. This is a very common laboratory strain that geneticists use. And then here's Seychellian simulants. So that's the experiment. So first, just if you concentrate on these three here, these three blue and purple ones, those are the three melanogaster strains. It includes the large and small embryo, and this W118 is pretty small. The error bars, so here 1% is 1% embryo length. And I said originally there's about 100 cells along the length of an embryo. So 1% embryo length is about one cell diameter. So the standard errors of her measurements turn out to be about a third of a cell diameter. They put their stripes in pretty precise places, and when you measure, each of these is about 50 embryos she measured. Okay? So it turned out the measurements are very, very precise. None of these are significantly different from each other. And actually, I think so this is looking at the statistical significance. This blue line here, which is a line way down here. So here's log, minus log p value. This is looking at the stripe positions for the three melanogaster lines. And there's no significance at all. In fact, you can say that they all put their stripes in essentially the same place down to the resolution on a single cell along the diameter of the embryos, despite what amounts to about 25 or 30% different egg length between India and France, and whatever else might cause them not to put their stripes in exactly the same place. They all put their stripes in the same place to the resolution of about one cell.
This is when there's already 14 divisions?
Yes. And they've made this nice blastoderm embryo, a single cell monolayer.
Is there any variation in the number of cells? You said that some of them can stay behind. Is there any apoptosis?
There is, but you know, I'm not really prepared to talk about it. What we've done, these embryos, what we actually do is these embryos actually get flattened a little bit to help give you a nice plane of focus. And we only look at embryos that happen to be oriented the same way. So we're not looking at the ventral side of one and the dorsal side or lateral side. So, and then we're just looking kind of at a region down, you know, the one kind of side of the embryo. We've more recently been looking at these things with full, complete 3D resolution and reconstruction, in which we also get the position of every cell three-dimensionally. And so we can count up the total number of cells in the entire embryo. And we've redone this analysis on the same embryos in full three-dimensional reconstruction. There is variation, and there are differences between the lines. So actually, those big embryos, there is variation in cell number, and there is variation between these lines, both within in cell density as well, which is to say, cell size differs as well between these, but that's basically all I can say about it right now. So it doesn't seem to matter in terms of where they put their stripes, at least within melanogaster. It just shows what a beautiful, robust system this is, and that they have evolved a mechanism to deal with the scaling issue. And there's been quite a few papers where people claim to have an explanation for this scaling phenomenon. But I'll actually show you one more slide.
This is somewhat of a relevant question, because the question is whether
absolutely
measure length in microns or fractions of
absolutely,
or in numbers.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's
relevant to the, right? And it's very relevant to the details of how you model it. So that's why we're quite interested in that. But so, you know. And also, the Berkeley people are doing the same thing. So, and they're I'm sure ahead of us. So that's melanogaster. They put their stripes in the same place. And actually, maybe I should. No, I'm not going to jump in. If you look between species now, it's pretty clear that this is Seychellia. It doesn't put its stripes in the same place as Simulans, which is this red one, and the melanogaster don't put their stripes in the same place either. So when you look between species, they're very highly statistical significance in kind of where they're putting their stripes. Okay.
But kids as well?
Has not been looked at carefully. We actually have a collaborator who's looking at it, and who's reported to me. We've sent them some of these exact same embryos, and he says it scales, but it's very preliminary. Just he told me the amount of with embryo length. He says they put more bicoid. The mother provisions more bicoid in the embryo, and that scales.
That's when the scaling comes.
That's at least one component of it.
More isn't enough to do it, because it's exponential decay.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the length scale of the exponential scales with the size of the egg.
So it's
really the mother which is setting
the
thing.
No. If it diffuses nucleus to nucleus.
But they're saying it's scaling with the length size.
Then that will scale with the length. The diffusion is nucleus to nucleus. Right. That'll
be. Yeah.
That's actually rather amusing. That there are movies of this early division cycle, so much pushing and shoving.
There's a lot of pushing and shoving, and so I say the newest generation of experiments now that we have uses live embryos. So we have live fusions, and So, you know, we're going to hope to look at that. But this clearly shows that, you know, like at least the three strains we've looked at, and to the extent we've looked at size differences, that doesn't matter. And melanogaster puts those stripes in exactly the same place. But when you look between the species, they seem to have evolved some differences in the precise placement of stripes, especially those middle stripes. And this just shows an overlay of embryos where you can kind of see the pushing of stripes. So the Seychellia stripes, kind of in green, are almost in the interstripe region for those central stripes in the other region. So they're pushed a substantial degree. We've done some genetic analyses. So if you take India and France, cross them, and go out to the F3, and I'll explain why I got to the F3 in a few minutes, but egg size is genetic, or at least there's a large heritability in the F3, I should see in the F2 also, but in the F3, they should be segregating for different combination of small and large, and you should get eggs of a lot of different sizes in the F3. And so we were just looking at whether or not the robustness in scaling breaks down when you cross these lines. And the answer is it doesn't, and dramatically so. So this is really a beautiful demonstration of the robustness of scaling. That is, I'm only showing the anterior borders of stripes, stripe 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Okay? These are the F3 embryos and their lengths. So we've created, we started with a small and large line. In the F3, you get embryos of all different lengths. These are the original parental lines, length, small, large. The F3 produce all these bloody different sizes. Every embryo knows its exact size, so relative to its length, it puts the stripes in exactly the same place. So every embryo knows its own length and adjusts
so
basically to say...
I mean, it could be, but the cells may have moved around.
The cells do move around. You can't identify a single place where a cell is. But the flatness of this is saying, relative to embryo length, a small F3 embryo and a large F3 embryo out here are putting their stripes relative to the length of that embryo in exactly the same place. I mean, these slopes are completely flat.
But I assume it's plausible that you could count the number of cells to the left of the boundary and the cells to the right, and in that unit, that it's even better.
It could even be better, and we do have some of those data here, but, you know, the hope was that we could investigate this to a much higher resolution in doing these full 3D reconstructions, where we also don't deform the embryos at all.
I think just by naked eye, it kind of looks like there is homogeneity in nuclear density along the
embryo. Well, we're not.
And you can imagine that modulation of density might be varying from embryo to embryo.
Yeah, and we have some sense, yeah, that actually the anterior and posterior actually maybe a little more clamped down than the middle stripes. But we did announce, I think I took that slide out, and you asked, in each of these embryos, in a particular embryo, this embryo, if its stripe 4 is a little below the mean, is its stripe 3 a little below the mean? So we're looking at the covariation of stripes. And there's a beautiful kind of relationship there that there is almost perfect covariation among adjacent stripes, and that covariance falls off with distance. So there are like little localized deviations that'll push stripes, but I showed that to motivate the simulant Seychellia. We also, and this was the last part of Susan's thesis, crossed simulans and Seychellia. Now, these are good species, which means that they should have evolved post-mating isolation. And indeed, they have. You can only sort of do the cross in one direction. If you do in the other direction, everything is inviable. And actually, when you do the cross in this direction, you can get fertile F1 females, but sterile F1 males. So the only thing you can do with this F1 female, the hybrid between the two species, is back cross it to one parental species or the other. So she did that in both directions out to the F3. And so we're going to see what happens. Okay, so we have to modify the design a little bit. And I'm actually going to show you two different experiments, but this just, it's kind of cool. So these are the original Seychellia simulans, difference in where they put their stripes. These are where the F1 embryos put their stripes. So for what an F1 embryo means, we've crossed simulans with Seychellia, and the simulan's mom produced an egg. Its stripes are in the same place as the simulan's mom's. So it looks like it's kind of a maternally inherited trait. These are Eve stripes. Eve is expressed somatically. So one copy of the sim, one copy of the Seychellia, Eve, is expressed. But it's expressing in the mother's pattern. So it looks like it's a maternal trait. And this is why we go to the F3 embryos, because you need to look at the F3 embryos to see the F2 segregation. Here's the F2 embryos. So these are the offspring of the F1 mom. The F1 mom has one copy of each genome, and they put stripes right halfway between the two. So it's like a nice additive genetic trait. So this is just kind of something about the genetic architecture of this trait difference.
This is consistent with the amount of being
state. Could be. That's right. Could be. That's right. It can't be Bicoid, probably, because the deviations are kind of mostly in the center of stripes. The anterior stripes are much closer to one another, and it's these middle stripes that part more. So it's hard to imagine that it's just Bicoid. I'm not going to tell you about these data, but on top of this, what she did is, so all these embryos, you know, you do the crosses, the moms lay the eggs, you collect the eggs, you throw out 95% of them, or actually 99% of them, because they're not at the right stage, and you just look at a small subset that are just at the right developmental stage to do this analysis. After she did this, these dead, fixed, stained, photographed embryos, she peels them off of the slide. So each one's put on a separate slide. We ground it up and made DNA, and then we actually genotyped the embryo. So she developed 25 markers, basically, 5 markers for each chromosome arm, plus one for the Y and one for the fourth chromosome. And she did a QTL analysis. So essentially we're doing a QTL analysis, and we can rule out Bicoid by that means, because we know where Bicoid is in the genome, and there's just no effect of Bicoid at all. Then I'll switch to the second experiment she did, and this does it all the way to the F3, okay? And so it's the same thing. So this is a complete independent experiment, but showed the same thing. Like, here's the simulan's mom. The yellow is the F1, looks just like the mom. The blue and yellow, two of these are the F2s, they're intermediate. And then the F3, one of the F3s, if you backcross to Seychellia, basically jumps all the way up to the Seychellia-like pattern. The F3 simulans in this kind of brownish actually kind of stays intermediate. So that's the thing. The point here really is that we've shown that genetically you can create novel phenotypes in terms of expression. These have evolved differences. And at least in terms of the means, we've created novel phenotypes. The interesting thing is, and this is just fascinating to us, these error bars are a little bit bigger for reasons I can't tell you than some of the other experiments, but they're still small. There's no increase in the variance. So in these F3 embryos, you'd think in this F3 embryos everything is segregating, and whatever is, you know, segregating for where they put their stripes should be segregating as well. We conclude, the QTL analysis substantiate this, there must be a very large number of genetic factors of small effect segregating for this trait difference, such that from one F3 embryo to the next F3 embryo, even though you expect in those F3 they should contain 3/4 Seychellia genome, 1/4 simulans genome, it doesn't matter which quarter of the simulans genome it is. they have enough of those little factors that contribute to the trait that all those F3 embryos pretty much have the same phenotype. And so this is essentially the same plot. This is back crossed to simulins, so they're smaller. The range of sizes are smaller of embryos. And back crossed to Seychellia, the embryos are getting bigger. So the range, you know, is bigger. They still overlap. But if you, and you can't see it carefully, but if you like were to mark exactly where these things are, they differ by a significant few percent that you could see on that previous graph. But these lines are still just like perfectly flat, and there's no change in the variance of these measurements from the F, from the original moms to the F1s, the F2, the F3. So it almost looks like we've gone through kind of a smooth evolution, and whatever the mechanism is that confers this very robust stripe position, every one of these embryos, we've created novel positioning, but these embryos all still know where, you know, they should be making their stripes, given that they're making them in a completely new place, or shifted one or two cells compared to, or several cells compared to the original parental lines.
They shifted in two, three cells. You know, they shifted by two or three times the average cell diameter.
Something like
maybe
that.
Not shifted in number
yeah, yeah,
at all.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, yeah. That's right. That's right.
And if you look, so, if you look at the fully developed larva, can you see this? So it's clear. It's an overall stretching of the middle bit relative to the others. Is that?
We haven't looked, but that's something we're doing. For sure, we're very interested in that. We're actually surveying a lot more lines now and a lot more species to see if we can find some really stronger candidates to do more detailed analysis. So there's a student looking at a lot more lines and a lot more species to see what we can find. But anyway, it's kind of interesting because this is actually a very old issue in evolution for developmentally canalized traits. So if you go back to, if you ever read about Waddington or something like that, traits that are highly canalized don't express much genetic variation because it gets buried in the canalization. That is to say, if you have a trait that's very highly developmentally canalized, it tends to be canalized both for environmental noise and genetic variation. Right? And so what Waddington did was show that if you perturb development by just environmentally shocking the fly or by adding a mutant or something like that, then you can show that, in fact, there's a lot of genetic variation that's actually hidden, that doesn't normally get expressed because somehow the developmental canalization just clamps it down and makes it not visible. My favorite example is work by a man named Rendell on scutella bristles. There's four bristles on the back of the fly called the scutellars, and all flies have four. It's a very highly canalized trait. It's a species characteristic. Some species don't have... Not species, but species groups have more or less, like five or six. But all melanogaster have four, and you can go collect a million flies, you'll never see one that has three or five. This just right means that it's developmentally canalized. There's also a mutation called scute, very common, well-known mutation. It affects scutellar bristle number. So various alleles of scute might take a fly down to an average of one scutellar bristle. But it'll be noisy. So, you know, certain scute 8 allele in a fly strain will have a mean of 1, but some flies will have 2, some will have none. And what Rendell did is he just put scute 8 into a bunch of different genetic backgrounds of melanogaster and then pooled them together so you had an artificial population with background genetic variation. And he did artificial selection. And he showed that indeed you could select and go from that mean of 1 all the way back up to a mean of 4. So there is hidden genetic variation for bristle number. It's just normally suppressed by the developmental mechanism that makes 4 and not 5 and not 3. And actually, part of the experiment was, he repeated this many times, a beautiful experiment, that as you select up to 4 again, even in the presence of scute, the bristle number variance goes down, essentially to 0 again. So you can kind of select up to 4, so that now, even though all those flies have scute in them, they all just make 4. So it's as if the canalization is reimposing itself now even in the presence of scute. And he kept selecting and waiting away. Eventually he found a mutation that jumped up above 4, and then there was a lot of variability again, and he could then keep selecting up. But it's just an example of canalization. And
this, to my mind, we think
is relevant because there's a lot of theories of speciation, you know, wonder whether or not you, whether species go through some kind of bottleneck or some kind of event that leads to a decanalization and the kind of exposure of hidden genetic variation that can lead to rapid selection. Here we have a very well canalized trait, and these species evolve, and they seem to be able to do it without actually, you know, breaking the canalization at all.
Can you remind us of the definition of canalization?
I don't want to even try. A lot of developmental biologists really don't like to use the word because it has a lot of
somewhat different
meanings. But Waddington meant it in the sense of developmental canalization, namely that if you look at early developmental processes or just embryos, things tend to be rather variable, and that as development proceeds, the phenotype gets more and more and more stereotypic. So that kind of the variance decreases. There's been a huge debate about this early segmentation, about whether that's actually occurring, whether the early steps, like how noisy is the Bicoid gradient, and then how much less noisy, or is the hunchback less noisy? Because you could see by the time you get to even skip, there's no noise to cellular resolution. Yet, if you look at the Bicoid gradients, they do vary by about 10% embryo length. So
genetically, this is coming from many.
So there's a lot of interest in this. And if you look at Eve stripe formation, you know, Eve, the stripes form. Eve comes on. It's very, very noisy. There's a very broad distribution of Eve expression, and the stripes start to form and coalesce, and then they just sharpen, and bam, right at when we're really looking at them, they're all in exactly the same place. But if you look at that sharpening process, they're much noisier earlier, and then there's a sharpening process. So there's a lot of interest right now among the developmental geneticists studying early embryogenesis in this issue.
But in the canalization picture, it's associated with different genetic variation, which sort of cancels out as you go through.
So right. So then it took on a meaning, sort of evolutionary canalization, that perhaps the reason that they have this kind of canalization is, or this canalization evolved to suppress environmental noise, and as it, you know, created some kind of developmental mechanism to suppress environmental noise, it also suppresses genetic variation. Or conversely, if you have a system that is very robust, you can get genetic variation accumulate that never really expresses. So it's effectively neutral as long as it can't get expressed. But it builds up, it's there, and Waddington and Rendell and others have shown it. It's a real phenomenon. And if you can break canalization, you expose a lot of genetic variation.
So the regulators, the financial regulators, ought to be trying to get the whole system much more canalized.
Right. That's what they're trying to do, right? So, okay, well, I'm finished. So the point is, going back to my original issue about, you know, whether there's some directionality to the evolution of these traits, again, here as well, looks like there's a very, very well-buffered trait, and it has some interesting evolutionary rules, but clearly there's evolutionary changes in where those stripes are. Now, we haven't tried to figure out what, at the level of the individual enhancers, whether they've evolved or what's compensating in the system or what's changing in the system, but clearly there are components that are changing the kind of the development landscape here, and that could ultimately affect kind of enhancer evolution and generate some directionality. So that's really the final point I want to make. I'm done now.